On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we debrief our visit to the New York State Association meeting in New York City last week, discuss the latest news and information, and do a focus segment on emergency preparedness and drills.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a bi-weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 39 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Monday, October 15th, 2018. We are recording from our studio in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey. John is one of the leading experts in all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry and the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry. John is a nationally known speaker and the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. So we are running behind this week. We've just had a very busy couple weeks, so we apologize for that.
Yeah, we usually drop the episode on the Sunday before the Monday that it's dated. Yep. And today we are recording on Tuesday, so yeah. We apologize because I know many of our listeners, like...
bated breath or whatever you call it.
So we apologize. So we just came back from the New York State Association meeting last week. That was on Thursday of last week. We recorded some segments for that. We haven't put together that episode yet. So if you're from New York State or interested in what's going on in New York State, that episode, we'll probably be finishing putting that up, and we'll record it for a date of next week, and we'll post it to the website. So keep an eye out for that. Anything you ever wanted to know about New York State. I'll tell you, that was a wonderful meeting. We were at the Roosevelt Hotel, which is a 30-style, like a Art Deco-style hotel. I loved
it. Very historic. It was nice.
Yeah. The rooms weren't so nice, but the but that's another issue.
Well, they're...
But the hotel, or the space for the meeting was great. And we got to meet a lot of, well, first of all, a lot of our clients from AHS were there in attendance, and as well as we had an opportunity to have a booth there and to tell everybody about what wonderful things AHS can do. And a lot of people were interested in the podcast. By the way, Sue, I noticed that our listenership is up significantly in the last 2 weeks.
Oh, yay.
We're actually coming close to 4,500 downloads, and we have an average of about 120 people a week that listen to us. So that's very good for a podcast that's this narrow in scope, so we're very proud of that. I should also apologize. We keep saying that we're going to be having some premium podcasts, and we keep pushing those off. It is simply because we are so busy with what's going on here, and we are working on them. It's just that we haven't gotten it done, and we have hired somebody to help us with them, but unfortunately, he was moved to another project right now. So we're kind of still short on people, but so Sue, why don't you tell us what's going on in the news?
Okay. Well, there's an issue that I want to talk about that I have discussed quite a bit in the past, but it's about the opioid crisis. And I know it's a concern to all of the medical community, but we often don't know how to make changes or which changes in practice would really be beneficial without interfering with our patients' comfort and the quality of care that we give. So in addition to our own desire to do the best we can for our patients, I know, John, there have been some cases in the news lately with doctors being held legally responsible for the patient's overdose deaths. There's a recent one, Dr. Diamond, a pain management doctor from Texas, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison. And he does seem to, you know, I don't know all the details, but he does seem to have been committing Medicaid fraud and prescribing pain meds unnecessarily. But some of his patients did defend him, and it is possible some of his patients may have been doctor shopping. And I know, you know, know, it just kind of raises that concern that you really have to be responsible for that kind of thing. And as I said, the overriding thing, though, is, of course, we want to do the best for our patients.
Right.
So I'm glad to see the government is offering more guidance. I found the details in ASC Focus Journal, the October 2018 edition, had this information. HR 6, Support for Patients and Communities Act. SUPPORT stands for Substance Use Disorder Prevention that Promotes Opioid Recovery and Treatment. So it was introduced to the House January 3rd, 2017. It was passed in the House and Senate recently, and now it's in the kind of resolving differences phase, and then it'll go on to the president. So this attempts to combat opioid and substance use disorder by addressing initial need for pain control, increased detection of addiction problems, and increasing availability of treatments. According to ASC Focus Journal, some ways that this will directly affect ASCs are, number one, pain management study. HHS, in consultation with stakeholders, will submit a report to Congress on how to improve reimbursement and coverage for multidisciplinary evidence-based non-opioid chronic pain management, which I know we've talked a little bit.
Well, because the CMS proposal for 2019 includes the provision to actually pay for non-opioid prescriptions. At this point, there's only one drug out there that meets that requirement, but I know a couple more are coming down the pike. So definitely look into that. I believe that drug is called Exparel.
I think so, yep. And this should hopefully increase the motivation of finding those
other
treatments. Reducing opioid use in surgical settings. Within 6 months, HHS will convene a TEP consisting of medical and surgical specialty societies and hospital organizations to recommend best practices for pain management in surgical settings. HHS must issue a public report within 1 year, so we'll keep an eye out for that. And the last one I wanted to mention was updates to opioid prescribing guidance. Within 6 months, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will post online all opioid prescribing guidance published after January 1st, 2016, applicable to Medicare beneficiaries. So, you know, it'll just be a good clearinghouse to be able to find all of that information.
Good. I did want to follow up, too, on one of our discussions regarding the new CMS proposals for reducing regulatory burden. And during my session at the New York State Association meeting, where I was talking about all the changes from CMS this year, one of the things I talked about was the provision for eliminating the need for a comprehensive history and physical. And so first of all, I should note that, and I don't think we talked about this on the podcast, but that the proposal probably is still at least 2 years away from actually getting implemented. So,
yes,
you know, don't rush off and immediately start making these changes based upon the proposal. But one of the proposals was to eliminate the requirement for a comprehensive history and physical and replace it with a focused history and physical. While on face, that sounds like a great idea, the concern that we all have is that doctors will interpret a focused history and physical as basically nothing. And we're concerned as an industry, as the ASC Association, as ourselves in our own company, that this could greatly diminish the quality of the preoperative information that we have and perhaps endanger patients if we don't look carefully to make sure the patient is really a good candidate for surgery. Interestingly, I had an individual come up to me after my session in New York who said, kind of disturbingly to me, he says, you know, we don't do these history and physicals anyway. So, you know, why are you, you know, why are you arguing that we need to do it? And I thought to myself, of course, I never think fast on my feet in that situation. It's like, well, that scares me quite a bit. If you're not to make an argument that nobody does it anyway, and that's why you should eliminate it is probably not appropriate.
No.
So again, there is no change in our requirements right now for a comprehensive history and physical. And important to note is that even though CMS might remove it in a couple years, doesn't mean the states are going to remove it. And it certainly doesn't mean that the accreditation organizations are going to remove it.
Yeah. And it could even be your own policy. I mean, who wants to be in the position of defending themselves if something goes wrong because they didn't look? Well, I just looked at this one specific area of the body. I didn't bother to look at everything else.
Right.
I mean, you know, the doctors can use their judgment to some certain extent if this passes.
Right.
Like you said, it's just concerning to cut too much out because you don't know what's there if you're not looking.
I should also point out this last couple of weeks, I've done a couple site visits where the nurse managers have pointed out that the history and physical actually lacked an indication that there was a problem with the patient. In other words, there would be a history and physical that would state within normal limits and the patient would be in for an arthroscopy or an eye surgery. And that, of course, is an immediate red flag that that history and physical isn't very valid.
Yeah.
So again, getting down to that argument, if you're going to do you know, if we were to move toward a focused history and physical,
that'd be a good one.
Right. At least make sure that you're focusing on that one area.
So. Yeah. Why are they here? There's no problem. Send them home.
Okay. So let's take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk about emergency preparedness.
So as we were discussing the changes to CMS, and particularly the emergency preparedness requirements last episode, we thought it was a good time to review the elements of a good disaster plan. I think the term disaster or emergency preparedness plan can be, you know, really misleading. It can be anything that disrupts normal business. It doesn't have to be what we think of as an actual, you know, disaster.
Right. Well, I mean, we know that the most recent hurricane in both in the Atlantic and in the Gulf always makes us think about major disasters like that. But there are all kinds of things that happen. By the way, the reason I was thinking about this is that you and I are going on a cruise in a couple weeks, and given Murphy's Law, that will be the next hurricane that comes out. So.
No, I think it's called John's Law now, because you do tend to be where disaster, the disasters happen. Yeah,
that's true. So let's talk about the different types of disasters or different types of things that we need to be prepared for. So there's the obvious major issues like flooding and natural, you know, hurricanes, tornadoes, power outages, et cetera. And civil disobedience. I should point that out is that we had a situation in one of our places in Texas where the flooding actually didn't do nearly as much damage as the looting did afterwards. So the area was flooded, and somebody broke into the facility and removed the drug boxes. By the way, they end up having to put in ongoing security in order to protect that that facility. Even after they had removed the drugs, of course, people keep coming back because they assume that there are more drugs in there.
I think that's a good point, too, is that part of the thinking through the drills and your plan, that process is thinking of the secondary things. Like you've mentioned facilities that have had a fire, and the fire is put right out. But it triggered the sprinkler system. So then you've got a flood to worry about.
Right.
You got
which
a flood,
is much
you dry
more damaging.
It. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and then you've got the mold a couple weeks later.
Right.
So it's always kind of following that through to the end and seeing, you know, what issues could you be dealing with.
Right. So not only should we be thinking about external disasters, but internal disasters. I just did a drill for incapacitated provider at our facility in Texas. And that was an interesting event because we brought everybody together. We did it as a tabletop because we had already done a live one. And we talked through these whole everything. And it was a very small facility. There's only two nurses there. There were three nurses, one doctor, and a CRNA. And so, you know, that we simulated that the doctor went down, the gastroenterologist went down, and then walked through what we would do with everything else. And it really generated a good 15, 20 minutes of discussion as to how they would handle that. And, you know, one thing to remember with a drill is we never expect it to go well. As a matter of fact, that's the whole goal there, is that you want it to be something that sparks a lot of conversation. And then you write up in your drill write-up all of the things that you had identified as potential problems and talk about ways in which you can minimize that or to address those issues. So a good drill is going to actually bring up a lot of discussion.
Yeah, the whole point is to learn from the drill.
Right. And I'm afraid that most of the drills that I see, both as a surveyor and also, you know, when we come into a new client, really are quite, well, they're done just because they have to be done. And I can't stress enough how important it is to really think these things through. We don't want to have a situation where we're not prepared for a fire. We're not prepared for some immediate onset of some type of a disaster.
Yeah, and solving those problems. I've talked to you about my concerns. When I was a nurse for the county here, we did some fire drills. You know, we do them frequently, and we were on the 10th floor. So, you know, it would take quite a long time to get downstairs. So it was a large building. There was a lot of people, you know, and I had brought up a concern one time, you know, what do we do? We're on the top floor. We're taking so much time to get out. And I would get, you know, not much of a response, just, well, in a real disaster, people would move quicker. Well, that's probably not true. You know, there's going to be smoke. Is there some other exit I could take? Is there access to the roof? You know, and I really didn't get much response. It was sort of like, well, we have to do the drill. The drill's done. Don't worry about
it. Yeah, don't ask any questions.
You know, and that was really, that was concerning to me.
I witnessed a drill about 6 months ago that quite disturbed me because all it was they set off the fire alarm. Everybody made a nice orderly exit out of the building. And then the nurse manager walked around the parking lot saying, don't forget to sign off on this.
Yeah.
There was no discussion. There was no, nobody even knew what the drill scenario was. There was one person who who pulled the fire alarm, who actually knew what the scenario was, but nobody else did.
No, all we ever knew was that we had to go down the stairs. Afterwards, we'd get an email, and generally it was just commenting on people that carried their coffee downstairs. Don't carry your coffee downstairs because we might slip. But it was sort of, so it just really didn't feel like a part of the process. Like we say, really, with any kind of a learning situation, the more people feel part of that process and respected and listened to, they're going to buy into it and they're going to get involved, and then they're going to take ownership of that. If the thing really happens, they're going to feel like they're listened to. There was another, although this wasn't a drill, but it was a better outcome because people listened to us, where as nurses, we weren't working the county hours. So they, when they would have holidays off, we would still have to be there. And here we were, this, you know, little group of nurses up on the 10th floor. There was no security, and many of us were out doing home visits. So there could be one person in this huge building by themselves. The elevators there sometimes broke down. So we brought that up and our concern about that. And we ended up being allowed to either work from home or remote site from there. So that really, that was a good solution. We worked that out. And that's really what you should be doing with drills, is learning what the problems are and how are we going to address these.
Right. So let's just reiterate what types of drills we should be going through. On a fire drills, you should be doing them quarterly. Mm-hmm. You should be pulling the alarm. They need to be scenario-based, so you run through a specific scenario that talks about where the fire is, who responds to that first, what you do after that, whether you evacuate, which is not always the case.
And when you're going to pull the fire alarm, you need to first contact your fire department.
Right.
There's some guidelines, and of course...
Well, yeah, if you're going to do a drill, make sure you contact the fire department first to tell them that this is going to be a drill and to be offline for a period of time.
And check and make sure.
Right.
The rest of the building that, you know, just don't start a panic.
And make sure the signal got to the fire department. So you have to follow up with them and make sure that they at least, to assure that they at least received the signal. Mm-hmm. So 4 fire drills a year, they should have a scenario. They should have a write-up. There should be any lessons learned, and there should be sign up or at least a list of the people that attended that drill. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you include the physicians. In New York State, a number of years ago, we got into real trouble in a center because during the entire year, none of the physicians were on the list of people that attended any of the fire drills, and they got into trouble for that, which then they had to do a plan of correction. And during the following year, they had to keep a list of all the doctors that hadn't done that. And that, of course, is very difficult. So make sure that anybody that's in the building at the time participates, including the physicians. And then from a disaster side, we talk about internal and external disasters. So there should be 2 external disasters per year. One would be, could be a tabletop where you just talk it through, you know, over a table. And still has to be scenario based. So you still have to come up with scenario, but walk people through that drill in a room without walking around.
And having a scenario, I think, just makes it more interesting. You know, you can really play it out and, well, what if this happens?
Right. Walk them through each of the steps.
Yep.
And then there has to be a live drill where you you actually walk around and you do. So, for example, if you're doing a active shooter, you have an individual that's appointed to be the active shooter. Everybody simulates what they would do as this individual is walking through the facility. That can be very interesting. As we've talked about in previous ones, my, you know, 5 foot, 6 inch daughter.
She loves that.
Yeah, she was jumping over counters, you know, simulating, you're dead, you're dead. Knowing her, she had way too much fun doing that. But it did stimulate a lot of conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily a fun conversation because I think we're all concerned about what happens with a gunman walking into one of our centers. And it has happened.
And she's had, she's had experiences
in the hospital that she used to work at.
So it's very real to her. Yep.
Now, we also discussed that the proposed changes to the CMS emergency preparedness regulations that, again, are 2 years out, would allow for, in addition to a tabletop and a live drill, what they call the workshop. There's no information yet as to what the workshop would be, but I'm excited about that because I think it could be a very useful tool. So those are the 2 external disasters and 2 internal disasters, which we're all doing anyway. These would be like a code blue drill. And if you're using activating agents, you would have a malignant hypothermia drill also. Another type of drill is like what I talked about we did earlier or last week, which is a incapacitated provider drill where you simulate what you would do if a provider went down during a procedure and suddenly you have 2 patients.
Yep. Yep.
So again, just like with in whatever scenario, either a fire or a disaster drill, you have to write up the scenario, be very specific about the steps that occurred, write up the response of each of the employees that witnessed it, talk about how you did everything right through to the end of the drill, and then write up your lessons from that and any discussion that you had afterwards so it's memorialized, and make sure you get a sign off on all the people that were there in the drill. Yep. So we didn't talk about, we kind of jumped ahead right into the drills. We didn't talk about how we design our disaster plan.
Yep.
And that comes down to having a good, what we call a hazard vulnerability analysis, an HVA. Mm-hmm. So you should be doing a hazard vulnerability analysis every year. There are a number of forms out there or example HVAs, which you can use. But the important thing here is you identify what are the most major issues that can confront you, like
what's most likely, and
right, like here in Rochester, we actually have earthquakes since we're in a 100-year earthquake zone, so that does show up as a top, as one of the major issues. Snowstorms, of course, which we're in October now; we're expecting one any day now, probably since it's already
this, could be,
given the way the temperature's dropping,
Which can mean power outages, closed roads. So there are all these offshoots from any one disaster. You have to really look at what are the effects of all of this.
So I remember 1990, a brand new facility we opened in Rochester. I think I'd been an administrator for less than 6 months, and we had what we called a major ice storm, which incapacitated all the healthcare organizations. Mm-hmm. Many of our employees were without power for 2 weeks. The surgery center was without power for 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Water was an issue in some areas.
And we actually were the only part of the building that had a generator, so we supplied power to the rest of the facility. Mm-hmm. And during that time, we had to figure out things like, what are we going to do with our employees? You know, we have full-time employees. Do we pay them? Do we not pay them? If you do pay them, what are they going to do, for that period of time?
Yeah.
In our case, we just, got caught up on everything in the facility. We brought them in. We had enough power, with the generator to be able to restock, clean, get caught up on all the paperwork, did some training, things like that. So those are the things you should be thinking about when an actual disaster occurs is, how to best utilize that time. Also, probably should put a push in for making sure that you have insurance to handle loss of business, like business interruption insurance. Is what helped us to pay the employees their salaries during that time frame, because we were out of business long enough that the business interruption insurance did kick in.
Okay.
So taking a good look at your insurance coverage, make sure that you're covered for a lot of these things is another important part of this. Yeah. So that HVA, that hazard vulnerability analysis, should be used to develop your emergency plan and your educational program for the next year, as well as all the drills. So if you identify that that you have a very high risk for an active shooter, you should be doing an active shooter drill. You should make sure you brush up your policies and do at least one educational program on it to reduce, again, the possible impact of not having any plan in place.
Yeah, so not many surgery centers will have the same risks as other ones. I mean, there could be, you have one that has a train track that goes,
which we
right nearby, the train could derail. Ones that do controversial procedures.
Right.
And then you there's a whole other danger there. So, you want to know what's specific to you. And I know another one we mentioned, that even if it's a disaster that doesn't affect your center, what was the one we had where the hospital, I think, went down, and that's where they got all of their...
That was in Ohio.
Yeah, medical.
Interestingly, that's a very good example, because that wasn't a disaster in the traditional sense. What had happened is the hospital had been hacked and had a ransomware situation, and their entire computer system went down. They literally went to paper for, it was more than a week.
Yeah.
And all of the pre-ops were done by the hospital, all the pathology, all of the preoperative testing was done at the hospital, and they literally had to do everything on paper for that period of time, which adversely affected the surgery center. They even had a problem communicating with the hospital because the telephone systems were impacted.
Yeah, I think they had to run over and pick up a lot of the paper, the lab results and things on paper, and it sounded like quite a big
deal
adjustment.
Yeah. And I think when you're looking at your hazard vulnerability analysis, you probably want to consider also the possibility of some type of a computer problem too. Very good point.
Okay, so after all that, I just wanted to mention Found Apex Guide from 2013, Infection Prevention for Ambulatory Care Centers During Disasters. Now, this is talking about a big disaster. It's a very detailed guide to controlling infection risks in an emergency or disaster situation. They stress that this guide is not going to replace your day-to-day infection control, but it can be used as part of your emergency management plan. And, you know, of course, you would coordinate with local and state authorities. It discusses triaging patients, isolation, dealing with water shortage or contaminated water, and even food safety. So it isn't probably something you would want to include in your regular training, as it's quite long. It's around 100 pages. But it could be very valuable just to kind of have it tucked away, you know, as a resource if something really big were to happen and you needed some guidance. And, you know, or you could just go through and find the areas that might apply to you and give you a little bit of guidance with that. So we'll put a link to that.
On the website, sure.
Okay.
Okay, let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about what's coming up in the ASC industry.
So, John, there is a lot going on with ambulatory healthcare strategies. Can you give our listeners an update on the company and its services?
Sure. Well, as you well know, we are growing fast. We now have 10 employees. You were number 9. We've since hired another summer intern, though I guess it's going to be a fall intern, actually, now. all of our employees are scattered throughout the East Coast with a cadre of independent consultants that we call upon when we need them. And probably one of the most exciting news that we had recently is Alex Borneman, our director of operations and our go-to guy for life safety issues, mm-hmm. passed his NFPA certification and became a CLSS-HC, which stands for Certified Life Safety Specialist for Healthcare. So we're now offering life safety surveys, which is something somewhat new to us, mm-hmm. And are included in all of our retainers.
So what is a retainer?
So the core of our business is really retainer-based services. While we regularly help centers out with mock surveys, survey preparation, and post-survey mitigation, the core of what we do is make sure that you don't have to prepare for a survey or deal with the complex post-survey plans of correction. To that end, we have a regulatory compliance retainer, which is basically a way for centers to outsource quality improvement, risk management, infection control, emergency preparedness, and other CMS and accreditation oversight services.
And what is included in that retainer?
While all of our services can be tailored to the exact needs of the organization, our standard retainer includes either monthly or quarterly visits to the center, review of all quality improvement, risk management, infection control, and emergency services activities and documentation, preparation for attendance at and preparation of the minutes for the quality improvement meeting, the medical executive meeting, and the governing body meetings. Annual updates to the policy and procedure manual to comply with state CMS and accreditation requirements. We also prepare educational programs for orientation and annual mandatory education, and we can actually do those educational programs too if you wish. And of course, 24/7 access to me and my incredible staff for issues that might come up.
Well, that sounds expensive.
Well, I think the price might surprise many of our listeners. But the way you have to look at it is this: how can you afford not to? Many of our centers simply cannot afford or cannot find an administrator that has all of the education, training, experience to handle quality improvement, risk management, emergency services, and infection control. And our service allows centers to hire good nurse managers that can focus on those things that they're best trained for, and we handle the rest.
So how do our listeners learn more about this?
Well, feel free to give me a call at 585-594-1167. That's 585-594-1167, or send us an email at info@ah-strategies.com. That's info@ahhealthcare-strategies.com. So welcome back. Our final segment here, we talk about what's coming up, and we should mention again, next week, we'll have a special episode for the New York State Association. And by the way, just a reminder that we now have an Ohio State Association, California Association, and New Jersey Association special episode. So anybody that in those states that would like to find out what's going on in those states, or people that are from other state that wants to know what's going on in those states, mm-hmm. make sure you look up on our website, ascpodcast.com, for those special episodes where you'll find out all kinds of things about what's happening there. Sue, the list is kind of short right now. I think we're, you know, the busy time of year, of course, is kind of ending right now in October. It tends to get a little bit quiet here and it'll start picking up soon. But I think we have a very short list. Every week we try to inform you of the upcoming events. And if you'd like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com. I also want to mention that if you have signed up for the CASC exam or the CAPE exam, the that's the infection prevention exam, don't forget to do that before the end of the month. So you take your test before then so that you'll have your results very soon after the end of the month.
So the 5th Annual New York Metro ASC Symposium is November 2nd, 2018 at the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square.
The CASA Infection, that's the California Association CASA Infection Prevention Seminar, is November 7th and 8th in 2018 at Costa Mesa.
2019 ASCO Winter Seminars are January 17th through 19th in Austin, Texas at the Hilton Austin. The 2019 conference will include three tracks: ASC Management Essentials, Coding Update and Reimbursement Strategies, and Infection Prevention Techniques in ASCs.
And I'll be doing, I think, two presentations there, and we will have most of our team actually will be there. Yeah. We don't have a booth, but we'll have most of us there. Maybe we'll do a special segment on the conference.
It'll be fun. I've never been to Texas.
Well, this is a great site, and we have a surgery center not too far from here, so we'll probably visit with the whole team. That'll be surprising. That'll be, I don't think they even have as many employees as we're taking down there, so
we'll overwhelm them.
But the winter seminars, if you haven't been to them, they are a great smaller venue opportunity for you to meet a lot of other people. It's not as big, obviously, as the ASCA conference itself. So you have a lot more personal interaction with the speakers and with each other. And it's, you know, during the wintertime, those of us in the north want to go south. So be down there in January, which leads us into ASCA 2019 at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee. One of my favorite venues, though I get so tired walking around that place. If you've not been to the Opryland Resort, it's like being outdoors, except you're indoors.
I've heard good things about it. I'm looking forward to that also.
So again, we'll have most of our team there, probably not the entire team since somebody has to actually work in this company. And that's May 15th through the 18th, 2019. I have three presentations I'll be doing there, including the CASC review course. So if you are interested in becoming CASC certified, that's the Certified Ambulatory Surgery Center Administrator Program. The course, which is held on the Wednesday, that's the 15th, is a good introduction, not only to just being an administrator, but obviously to being able to determine whether you're prepared to take the CASC exam. So definitely sign up. By the way, I think we're already past the early sign up for the winter seminars, but you definitely want to take advantage of those discounts by becoming a member of the ASC Association, as well as signing up early so that you can get the lowest prices. Well, that's it for this edition of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in 2 weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including The Survey Guide for ASCs, A Guide to the CMS Conditions for Coverage and Interpretive Guidelines for Ambulatory Surgery Centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.